collision avoidance, often abbreviated as CSMA/CA. There are lots of variants that have been done to 802.11, which was originally only a 2 megabit per second system. Those of you who use the networks around here mostly encounter 802.11b with data rates up to 11 megabits per second, and some of you may have encountered 802.11a in the 5 gigahertz band with data rates up to 54 megabits per second, or nowadays 100 megabits per second. Originally, A wasn't allowed for use in Sweden because of interference with things like radar systems, etc., and so another approach was used, 802.11h, which actually basically adopts some rules from Hyperlan, which says, what do you do? Well, before I start using one of these frequencies, I go and listen and see, is there a radar system or somebody else using this? If there is, then don't use that frequency. Use a different frequency. And there are loads more. The most recent one of interest, perhaps, to you is 802.11n, that supports up to 248 megabits per second. And amazingly enough, at the same sort of power levels as cellular telephone. And this was a very big shock. One of the guys who worked in my lab many years ago from Japan came back and gave a presentation to some people at Ericsson's broadband group, and they heard, oh, 100 megabits per second, etc. And then he started pulling out the chart showing the power consumption, and their jaws just dropped because they realized this is 100 megabits per second at cellular telephone power levels. And what was even more shocking to them was the fact that he said, well, this is the product we're currently shipping. Yes, and they're selling millions of them already. And so things, as they say, are changing real fast. There are two possible approaches to configuring network inside wireless LAN environments, and one is the independent configuration where you simply form ad hoc networks. The devices simply communicate with each other. The other approach is the infrastructure approach where you use access points attached to some infrastructure and off you go. There are lots of terms. You can study these happily on your own. You can study about the details of the media access and control protocol, but the most important thing is the idea that, as usual, just like in the Ethernet case, there's spacing between the frames, the so-called DIF, and then following that, you look to see if the media is busy. If it's busy, you defer your access, and then comes a period of time of contention, where if you want to get access, you have to contend for it. When you do get access, then you get a chance now to transmit, and you repeat this on and on. And by giving different people a different idea about which set of slots they should try to compete for, you can actually support different priorities. And this is done through the so-called distributed coordination function. It's a giant distributed algorithm running between these. After you transmit, you wait a short interval, and then you send an acknowledgement. So the result is, for every packet that you're sending, the access point, in this case, on the uplink, is sending you an acknowledgement. And the reverse is true. There's also a clear-to-send model. Here, the source sends a request to send. After a period of time, it gets a clear to send. Now it sends the data and gets an acknowledgement. And this is used to avoid problems of multiple entities trying to send at the same time, particularly when they can't hear each other. And this is basically what a frame looks like. It looks very, very much like an Ethernet header, except it has some additional addresses in it. If we look at the frame control, there are a number of additional bits, such as, is the frame encrypted? Is the station in sleep mode or not? Because one of the fascinating things is people in wireless LAN realize that, gee, sleeping is again important, like in pagers. So the result is, in an infrastructure mode, a mobile device can say to the access point, hey, I'm going to go to sleep for 100 milliseconds. if any packet arrives in the next 100 milliseconds, it's simply buffered in the access point. And now when the station wakes up, it queries the access point saying, hey, have you got any traffic for me? And if there is, now the access point takes the traffic out of the buffer and sends it to me. The advantage is that for some increase in latency, I decrease my power consumption, right? And if you're all as lazy as I am, the idea is you should sleep as much as you can, right? Then you have plenty of battery power. Not surprisingly, the phases of using the network are you have to get started. So you have to turn on and discover. So you have to determine what are the access points available, find out their SSID, which is the system identifier, and other parameters like what data rates are used, etc., and then negotiate. And that involves authenticating yourself and associating with the access point. And the discovery can either be passive or active. I can listen for beacons from the base station, or I can go and say, hey, is there a beacon in capable access point on this network? If so, respond to me. The bad problem is I have to wait to hear whether it responds. If there isn't an access point using that channel, how long do I have to wait? I can wait until something freezes over and, right, there's going to be no response because there's nobody listening on that channel. And if you actually look at the original specification, it says that you have to do this for all the channels. And here in Europe, that means 13 different channels. So the result is, if I rely on the low-level MAC protocol to find a new access point, what's going to happen? Well, I start with channel one. I say, hey, anybody there? Or I listen. Whoops, no response there, so I switch to channel two, and I repeat the whole process, and I do that 13 times. Right? So finding a new access point can take a very long time. Now, in 802.11b mode, does anyone know how many orthogonal sets of channel assignments there are possible? Well, if you go and read all the details, the neat thing is you find there are only three. Well, if I used to be using one of the channels, and I can't use that channel anymore, and I don't find somebody else on that channel, I know not to look there. As a result, there are only two other ones that I can possibly use that wouldn't be interference with in 802.11b mode. So what do? I switch to one of them, and I've got a 50% chance of being right. And if I'm wrong, then I simply switch once more, and I'm done. So I can do it in at most one change more than the minimum I have to make, which is, of course, one change. Right? Otherwise, I had to go and listen and try this process on all 13 channels before I could go back and say, okay, yes, that's the one I'm going to use. So a difficulty for many people is they take 802.11 as the literal base and say, I have to do everything in 802.11. Whereas instead, there's nothing that says I can't use higher layer knowledge and simply tell my 802.11 interface, switch to this channel, send a query to see if there's an access point there. Okay. If the subtlety of that escapes you, don't worry about it. Go and read the standard. For authentication, I basically have to somehow convince the access point that, yes, this is who I really am. And in the infrastructure mode, it's going to probably go off and do an 802.1x query of a RADIUS database and decide whether I'm allowed or not. Well, there are two major forms of authentication, the open authentication mode and a shared key mode. In this mode, I actually have to have a shared secret with the access point because all of our communication is going to be sent in encrypted form. What is that encryption? Well, it has this mysterious name called wire equivalent privacy. And if you've ever seen someone tapping wires, you realize that wires have very little privacy. right? If you can get access to them, you can tap it. The problem is that lots of people were very concerned about thinking, oh, I'm going to be radiating all of this information, and all someone needs to do to listen is put up an antenna. Yes. But a problem was that the algorithm that they chose for this turns out actually not to be very secure. And so these three people, this is one of my former students, the one who did mobile IP, attacked it based upon a theoretical attack that Flor, Mantin, and Shamir had written a paper about, and these three did their attack in 4 days, from start to finish. And John told me that the biggest delay was they had to get the equipment. Yes. So in under 4 days, they took the theoretical knowledge, implemented it, and had it running, and were breaking web keys. That's not a very secure system. Right? So this caused some problems because, of course, yes, all of these access points had web built into them, and they were only designed to support web. So how could the security be improved? Well, that took lots and lots and lots of time, and at least 2 major iterations. But first, how do handoffs happen? Well, if I'm using this access point and I move along, I look for an access point that's got a stronger signal than the one I've got. If so, then what I need to do is send a probe request, say, yes, it's there, authenticate myself, and now do a reassociation so that this is the access point I'm using and not this access point. All of that takes time. So one of the ideas was, well, if I've already accessing via one access point and I've already been authenticated, why not simply pass that information from my old access point to my new access point? And that was done by a protocol called the Inter-Access Point Protocol, standardized in 802.11f. And this speeds up the handoffs quite a bit. The bad problem is almost nobody implemented it. Yes. Oops. Too bad. So how can we do fast handoffs? Well, it turns out there's been a lot of work, and John Olivatin did a very nice dissertation about this some time ago. But it turns out the problem isn't even this finding, where's the channel, etc. The problem turns out to be accessing the radio server and doing the 802.1x protocol. And as I mentioned yesterday, the bad problem here is this may take a long time, perhaps several seconds. So the fact that it cost me several hundred milliseconds to do all of these other things, that's not the problem, because if I'm waiting for this radius authentication for several seconds, I've lost any sense of having smooth handovers. And in addition to the distributed coordination function, there's a so-called point coordination function, and this basically is to be able to deal with better handling of stations by explicitly polling them to decide, aha, by polling the station faster, I can give it higher priority. So 2 years ago, I had 2 students from France who did a very neat thesis related to this, saying, well, we don't need any of this. If instead we agreed to cooperate, we can all get better service by simply listening to the fact that for voice over IP, the active stations transmit packets through the access point. The access point knows who has a voice over IP session. Now, when packets arrive for the stations, instead of individually sending the packets out, instead it multiplexes them together into a big frame and transmits that jumbo frame, right? Because otherwise we'd only be sending small little bits of data to lots of terminals. And there's some superb work done by some researchers at Grenoble about the difficulties of stations in sharing this channel, because all you get is equal chance to get the channel. It doesn't mean you get an equal share of throughput. And since the access point has to send just as much data back on average as all of the mobile users send in voice, oops, we've got a problem. But by having the access point send these big frames out as a multicast to all of the terminals, it only had to contend once to be able to send lots of packets in the reverse direction, which improves things. And these two students then said, well, gee, if I look at that big packet, I can see which order my data is in that packet. So what I'll do is I will use that ordering for the ordering that the people will send data in the other direction. Right? So if you got your packet on the downlink before I did, I simply wait for you to receive your packet, and I got it at the same time. But now I wait for you to send your packet in the other direction, and as soon as you send your packet in the other direction, then I send my packet in the uplink direction. Did we have to contend? No, we simply cooperated, right? It's like lots of people headed for a doorway. If they're very polite, what do? Well, you adjust your speed so that at the doorway, people just merge together. There's no contention. And they showed that you can enormously increase the throughput for voice communications on a wireless LAN without having to change to a more complex coordination scheme. And it's all about, in the case of PCF, about adjusting these time intervals. Timing and management are important, as that we mentioned about sleeping and then dozing. You can say, okay, I want to sleep, but I want to wake up once in a while, and when I wake up, I want to quickly find out, is there any traffic waiting for me? If not, I'm immediately going back to sleep. These systems synchronize themselves rather precisely within 4 microseconds of the clock in the access point, and the performance is pretty good. Enrico Paletta has done a number of measurements for throughputs between access points, and the variance is quite interesting. It depends even on which way the antennas are oriented, depending on which way the devices are oriented. John Olive Botten did some excellent measurements and description in his dissertation for how to improve handover. And there's been lots of work done on AAA, as I mentioned earlier, 802.1x, and how to improve it. And these are 3 recent thesis projects on non-binary 802.1x. Interestingly, just like wide area cellular systems, there's lots of interest in roaming for wireless LAN. So maybe I have a provider like Telia here in Sweden by their home run network, and now I go and visit in Spain, and I want to have wireless LAN connectivity there. Can I get it or not? Well, that depends on whether there's a roaming agreement or not. I go into an internet cafe, and of course I can pay my money for wireless connectivity there, but I've already paid for wireless connectivity in Stockholm. Why should I have to pay again? So there are lots of people trying to understand how can you do roaming in these systems. And of course, one approach is use clearinghouses. So you just simply say everybody sends their equivalent usage records to a central point. It sorts them out saying, the Swedish provider owes this amount of money to this Spanish operator. The Spanish operator owes this amount of money for their customers who are in Sweden, etc. You can use interconnect providers, and there are lots of more things you can read about it. There's this nice paper by Luis Munoz and others, and here the idea is, classically there's been this problem about TCP/IP performance over wireless links. And the problem is when packets get lost, TCP/IP assumes that it must be congestion. Therefore, it slows down until it gets an acknowledgement. Oops, this is very bad. So instead, what you can do is you can insert a proxy. And what the proxy does is it receives the packets, takes responsibility for it, forwards them on, and when there's an error, it intercepts the request and forwards locally a duplicate copy of the missing packet. So you didn't have to wait to get all the way back to the other end, the real source, However, there are numerous problems in trying to do this right to not break TCP's semantics. There's even an activity called the Lightweight Access Point Protocol, and it's based on a project that was done here at KTH together with some other researchers in Europe to say what's the minimum amount you have to put in an access point. And the key observation is the access points usually have high bandwidth connectivity in the infrastructure. So therefore, does the access point have to worry about how to handle me when I first arrive and try to access that access point locally inside the access point? No. It can simply send that information onto a server somewhere on the network, which can decide, yes, this user is going to get service. The only thing that access point has to do is when I send it packets, it has to forward them into the network. And when it gets packets for me, it has to forward them out the wireless interface to me. Therefore, you can make an extremely low-cost access point. But that means you actually have to split the media access and control protocol into separate pieces. There's also work about Hyperlan. If you're interested, you can read about it. But basically, ETSI tried to understand how to make a European equivalent of wireless LAN. Yes, it should be different, of course. And it had wonderful, nice features, but basically everyone said, who cares? Because 802.11 devices were selling for almost nothing, and you could buy them by the carton, the case, the tractor trailer truck. Could you buy Hyperlan interfaces? Oops, no. So the net result is 802.11 took off. We talked about these additional standards again. Don't worry about the details of them. There's 802.11k to try to deal with resource management issues. There's 802.11p, and this is a very interesting activity because here the goal is to actually provide 802.11-like communications for vehicles. Right, so you're driving down the Autobahn at 150 kilometers per hour because, of course, going faster would not be environmentally sensitive. And someone zips by you at 180, and they want to, of course, send you the virtual finger or whatever. So what do? Well, they want to send you packets. And what's the easiest way and cheapest way they're going to do that is, of course, wireless LAN. And this particular standard is designed so that vehicles can communicate with each other. Of course, when you get the wave messages coming back from the other direction saying, oops, there's a pothole ahead, perhaps you want to slow down because I'm sitting in it, then your system can automatically start applying the brakes, etc. In addition to communication between vehicles, there's even communication between vehicles and roadside systems. So the idea is that you can basically have smart posts along the road that are going to communicate with the vehicles as they go past. So the vehicles can know, hey, there's a school zone ahead, start to slow down, or maybe speed up, depending on your inclination. Why does it have to be different than the normal 802.11? Because you want this to happen reliably. Right? You can't say, oops, I lost that message about the, you know, collision ahead, and whoops, I've, yes, joined it. So there's some changes that have been made to try to increase the reliability and deal with the fact that these are moving vehicles. There are also multi-hop networks, and we talked about Ricochet yesterday. There are lots of people who have tried to use multi-hop with wireless LAN. There are even new kinds of multiple access protocols. But more importantly for us are perhaps the introduction of wireless internet service providers, or WISPs. Lots of you see them in internet hotspots like airports, hotels, coffee shops, etc. There's also single site or campus WISPs. There are mobile carriers that are offering wireless LAN connectivity. There's ISPs that are basically providing wireless ISP service. And they're pure WISP providers who don't do anything else except actually run and operate a wireless ISP. There are operator-neutral WISPs, they're franchising WISP, they're virtual WISP, because, hey, if mobile virtual network operators were a good idea, then maybe being a virtual WISP is a good idea. One of those is Boingo. And then there are even community and grassroots WISP, like New York City's Wireless, there's one in San Francisco, and there's a public one in Philadelphia. And there are several here in Sweden. And if you want to read more, you can read more about all these things. Any questions? A really rapid run through of wireless LAN. We'll talk now a little bit about Bluetooth. Of course, the important thing was it's named after the Danish king who basically got all of these various tribes together. And one of the reasons that it's called Bluetooth was the fact that every different vendor wanted to do something differently between the headset and the phone. And although they make a lot of money selling those wires, each one, of course, with a specially designed jack so they're incompatible, people hated having all those different wires. And so the idea is what we need is a wireless wire replacement, and that's what Bluetooth is. And it was designed to unify all of those different attempts. It formed a special interest group, and they said our goals are low cost, low power, and primarily a cable replacement. They want to use short-range radio technology, use ad hoc networking, and be able to dynamically discover other Bluetooth devices in the services they offer. Here's the protocol stack. So there's a little radio, a logical link control adapter, and then various sorts of higher layer services up here. And the physical layer is simply the same 2.4 gigahertz as used for wireless LAN, and it hops at 1600 hops per second across 80 channels, except if you're in France, and then it only hops over half that number of channels, because the other half were initially, at the time, used. Now, what's the difficulty for this? Well, Bluetooth pseudo-randomly hops between these channels, because the only way that they could operate in the 2.4 gigahertz band was to use some form of spread spectrum, so they wouldn't interfere with normal users who are there. However, they violate one basic rule, and that is when you hop to a frequency, it doesn't listen to see whether anyone is already using the frequency. It just goes ahead and transmits. So guess what happens when you put a Bluetooth device near your wireless LAN? The Bluetooth device interferes with your wireless LAN, right? Because some of the time it's going to hop through frequencies, which are the frequencies you're using for wireless LAN. What happens then? Well, it either corrupts your packet and it's not recoverable, or it completely destroys your ability to operate because your device listens before transmitting, as it's supposed to do, and says, oh, someone's transmitting there, I'll wait. And 1/1600th of a second later, the Bluetooth is gone, but you're still waiting, saying, oh, somebody was using it, I have to wait till the minimum separation between packets. So your throughput drops way down. So I've often thought, and this probably shouldn't be quoted outside this room, the real purpose of Bluetooth was to destroy wireless LAN. Right? Because wireless LAN was competing, after all, with the cellular business, and if we look at this set of people, lots of them were interested in the normal cellular business. The transmit power is designed to be very low because you're going to have the battery in this earpiece or something like that. You couldn't have a kilo worth of battery there. And so the target was set at 10 meters. However, there was some envy there. And the result is there's also a class 1 specification for Bluetooth to support 100 meter range. Interestingly enough, a very large number of Bluetooth devices are class 3 devices. Their power level is 1 milliwatt, and the target range is 1 meter. Why so many devices that communicate only for 1 meter? Anyone want to hazard a guess? Yes. For headsets, cordless mice, things like that, the result is you don't need very much range. right? Because there's not that much distance from here to my pocket, right? I don't need 10 meters of range for that. And what happens when I drop the range? The battery lifetime goes up, right? More than linearly. Now, not only do we have different classes of devices, but we have two different roles that nodes can be in, either a master or a slave. And every Bluetooth device is either a master or a slave, and every ad hoc network can only have one master. Now, one of the massive failures in Bluetooth was the fact that the master assigns a so-called active member address, abbreviated AM_ADDR, to the slaves. Well, that's not a bad idea. The bad mistake was the protocol only allocated 3 bits for these addresses. And as Gordon Bell, the designer of the PDP-11, later the VAC, said, the one mistake that an architect can never recover from is not having enough bits of address. Right? So why did they allocate only 3 bits of addressing? Well, because initially they thought this was only going to be used with a headset and a phone and maybe a couple other devices, so they threw in, you know, an extra bit or two. The problem became, now, if I think about my desktop, where there might be a cordless mouse, a cordless keyboard, a stereo headset, a mono headset, a PDA with Bluetooth in it, a phone with Bluetooth in it, yes, we can quickly exhaust the address bits available. So what happens in that situation? We don't have enough bits to address all of these devices. So instead what we have to do is we have to essentially put them on hold, assign the address to someone else, communicate with them, put them on hold, go back, reactivate this device, give it an address again, and communicate. Much more complex than wireless LAN, which simply uses more addresses, right, 48-bit address space. So then I could communicate with all of these devices without this problem of having to put devices into park state. Now, we said it uses fast frequency hopping. Every device has a 48-bit MAC address, but they're not transmitted. Instead, that MAC address is combined with a clock that increments every 312.5 microseconds. That gives us our hopping rate. And that combination is used to compute the next frequency to hop to. So given the MAC address of the master, everybody knows the order to hop to different frequencies. And everybody happily works together. The problem is, if you're hopping around, right, how do you find these other nodes? Well, the nodes hop around listening. But if there are 79 different frequencies that you can all be hopping around, what's the probability that you both hop to the same frequency at the same time? Very small. Okay, so the trick is when you're searching to discover a Bluetooth device, you only hop in a certain pattern. And everybody knows what that pattern is. And when masters are looking for devices, they look in that sequence at twice the speed that the other devices are hopping around, so hopefully they eventually find each other. The difficulty is, oops, that may take 10 seconds. Okay, now think of the user. They have their little Bluetooth whatever device here. They're walking along at 2 meters per second. Hop, 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 hop. Meanwhile, that's hopping around. The difficulty is I can be long past it before we both hop to the same frequency, so I don't discover it. Right? My probability of discovering it is very small in walking past it. And so Cécile Aron, I hope I got that pronounced right, did a very nice thesis a couple years ago talking about, no, what I actually want to use is wireless LAN to tell me when I enter this region, hey, there's a Bluetooth device in that region, and this is its MAC address. So the result is when I enter the region, what do? I go and page that particular MAC address, and since I know its MAC address, I can quickly find it. Boom, I can discover it very quickly. So this Bluetooth discovery problem is quite a complex one. In addition, there's this problem about, since we're time multiplexing these channels, the master assigns the slots to the slaves, and then packets can be sent in groups of one, two, or three slots. And there's a nice thesis a couple years ago about how to do the scheduling for that. Because you either get polled and you have data, or if you're polled and you have no data, what happens? You just wasted the time slot. Right? Because everyone is moving through these time slots together. There are two basic forms of networks that can be used. The base form is a piconet, one master and several slaves. And we can have a slave that's part of two piconets that can pass packets from one to the other, and that lets us form something called a scatternet. And there's been lots and lots of theoretical papers written about scatternets. The bad problem is basically almost no devices actually implement them. Enough about scatternets. Now, Bluetooth also supports voice, and yes, it had to introduce its own new codec for voice. It supports synchronous connections for voice, so it could have very high voice quality, and it could support up to three voice channels being active at the same time. However, it has 78% overhead, which I think is absolutely outrageous, and that's without forward error correction. If you turn on forward error correction, it has even more overhead. And then all the rest of the bandwidth that's available can be used for asynchronous links. So if you have no voice activity at all, you can get a maximum data rate of 650 kilobits per second. Oops. And then you can read all about the baseband if you want and the packet formats, etc. In addition, of course, this system supported security, and here they actually got rather good. They used the so-called SAFER algorithm developed at Altejo Zurich, and it uses 128-bit ciphers and keys. However, a hard problem here is that for the two devices to be able to initially talk to each other, what's used is a PIN code. What's the bad news about this? Okay, what's the PIN code of nearly every Bluetooth device sold? Yes, 000. Zero. Right? So it's not a big surprise when you meet a Bluetooth device initially, gee, you probably know what the PIN is. So now you can set up a security association with it, and you can have this very nice ciphering, but it didn't provide a whole lot of security. What's the problem about providing much higher level of security than that? Okay, you take off your little Bluetooth earpiece. Where can you read on it the longer PIN code, and are you going to enter that into your device? No. So it's not clear that there's a really giant win here. And you can read all about the various different protocols, etc. Now, one of the hard problems for Bluetooth is the fact that the device has to say which profile it supports. Because, yes, rather than just simply sending frames, Bluetooth built these very elaborate protocols like telephony protocol, LAN adapter protocol, et cetera, and now you have to know which particular protocols you can support. But everybody's supposed to support basically a generic access protocol, and typically that means that I can emulate a serial link. Gee, yippee. It supports various low power modes, and as we said, there are issues about interference, and there's a nice thesis by Magnus Carlsen about this, and you can read lots more. I mentioned last time about ultra-wideband, and just a quick reminder about that, extreme low power levels. Right? We just saw Bluetooth at 1 milliwatt. We see ultra-wideband at 0.1 milliwatt to 1 microwatt. What's the advantage here? Well, it means much, much longer battery lifetimes, or higher data rates while still having reasonable battery sizes. There's been a lot of work in the IEEE 802.15 working group on personal area networks, WPANs. 802.15.1 is basically an adaptation of Bluetooth, and then there are lots more here, in particular 802.14 for interactive toys, sensors, etc. And there's lots of activity happening on this front because increasingly people want to build whole networks of wireless sensors. So shortly we'll talk about that. Say a few moments about broadband wireless access. Classically, the need here is just data, not voice. Downlink speeds at fairly high rates, 0.5 megabit per second, and the goal usually wireless metropolitan area networks. And there are lots of contenders here. There's just been incredible fighting, but today mostly it's being centered around WiMAX, specified in IEEE 802.16. We said yesterday that one of the goals here was to quickly be able to put up a high bandwidth wireless link, typically point-to-point or point-to-multipoint, and the initial systems were designed to be really very simple. Interestingly, we see either 256 point or 2K FFTs. That means orthogonal frequency multiplexing. It works because we have cheap signal processors. A bunch of standards, and fascinatingly, operating range of 10 to 66 gigahertz. Why such high frequencies? Because other people weren't using them, right? And by being very directional, you could have high data rates because at these high frequencies, you could get a lot of bandwidth. And so it's not unusual to find these systems supporting 70 megabit per second link bandwidths. And there's a very nice thesis by Xin Bai, who actually did field measurements of WiMAX, and he went around and actually said, okay, they're supposed to get these high bandwidth, do they? And so it's an interesting thesis to read. Another question was, is it data only? Could we send voice over IP over them? And Flextronics has worked together with the Flash OFDM developed by Flareon to produce a voice over IP handset using what was designed to be a data-only network. WiMAX terminals have been built by Nokia and others. There's also been a proposal that's sort of been an on-again, off-again architecture, which is 802.20, also called MobileFi. And here was basically the idea of companies saying, well, we want to carry IP packets, we want mobility, we want modest data rates, but certainly 1 to 4 megabits per second, and we want good mobility and coverage, and therefore it needs to operate in a frequency below 3.5 gigahertz, because above that, the chips start getting very expensive and the range shrinks, and this would support up to 15 kilometer radius cells and to exploit multiple antennas, in particular smart antenna technology. There's also 802.22, wireless regional area networks, and you can go and read about this if you want. And then there are various sorts of all IP networks that have been proposed. And the most important thing, of course, is it eliminates signaling system 7. Okay, any questions? If no questions, let's take a 5-minute break and then we'll come back and talk about sensor networks. Remember, we're nearing the end.
About
changing from SL card to dynamically
so doing that.
Yes.
Using just your mobile phone.
Yes.
Okay. So is there much written about this?
No.
Then that might be interesting.
Easy place to start is there's a very nice paper by a set of hackers who had a Boston system.
Okay.
And it's basically the same.
Okay, in fact all of them are here.
So basically, it can tell you how it works. It'll give you a nice background for how the system works.
Okay.
You're not worried about hacking it because you're going to actually have the legitimate data to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to know how does it work, what are the protocols, and then you want to say, okay, can I automatically know where I am so I know the right one to present?
Okay, so.
Right, so am I in Stockholm or am I in Helsinki? I can do cell IDs, I can do GPS, I can do a variety of sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
That may give me a hint as to which card I should use.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing.
But there's nothing written, is there written about that? Or only
no, there's nothing that? Ever been written as far as I know about this dynamically being different kinds.
Because that seems like something that could have been anything on the table.
Yeah. Well, remember how long took to get these micro cards in operation.
Mm-hmm.
Years.
Oh, right. Yeah. They don't work now either.
Yeah.
That's a fairly
Although
old technology.
It's an old technology, and it's dead as a company, basically, although there's remnants of it still. But the idea of combining multi-hop with such systems, if you talk to another Professor Jens-Anders student, he is working at relay type technology.
Okay.
And it's very reminiscent of what's been used in Ricochet.
Okay.
And if you get interested in that, send me an email and I'll send you a pointer.
Okay. But Ricochet is not there because
no, there's
still possibility.
Oh, yes.
Even in
Sweden. Yes. There are only a very small number of people still operating on Ricochet networks.
Hmm.
But multi-hop networks, there are bunches of people doing that. But understanding why it failed and where its problems were and what its architecture is, that's really interesting.
Yeah. Wireless LANs and wireless ISPs.
Yeah.
I was wondering a little bit about the wireless ISPs, what there is.
Will you?
I mean, I saw a little bit, but never mind. I think it's still like the first one. So that link to that.
Yes, if you go to if you send an email, you can see there's a group of German hackers who have made a device that can basically read these cards,
mm-hmm.
and they've now built another one that can basically act like a virtual card.
Okay.
And if you go to holtonpcb.org, you will find it. PCB.org.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so we'll resume to talk about sensor networks. Now, sensor networks, of course, build upon the idea of these mobile ad hoc networks, often called MANETs. So here we have an ad hoc network, which means these devices need to discover each other, form links with each other, and then communicate. But we can now combine those together with mobile IP, and we get something called MIT-MANET. And if you follow that paper, it's a paper with some former students of mine at the very first conference that ACM organized about MANET. And the interesting thing there is it showed how using multiple gateways between mobile ad hoc networks combined with mobile IP can give you some very nice features. Okay, what are sensor networks for? Well, the goal is often things like environmental monitoring, traffic, heating, ventilating, air conditioning, security, industrial, sensing and diagnostics, infrastructures, battle.